Welcome. This is a Lebanon-Israel special, considering all the latest developments down there. I think it would be necessary to spend some time on this issue outside of the regular Red Ice radio broadcast, and I've invited Michael Tsarion to get his view on this. We have, at this point, I guess, the Hezbollah firing missiles into Israel, and we have airstrike retaliation from the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. They are dropping tons of bombs on different locations in Lebanon, and I guess that many civilians at this point are being caught in the middle of this. And now there are coming out reports that say that Israel might be even be prepared to for a possible ground invasion of Lebanon. And we also have people like Newt Gingrich saying that this is World War III, the beginning of it. And I don't know how far this will go. I guess only time will tell here. But this fighting has been ongoing since the beginning. I guess it goes back to about 1948 when Israel was first declared as a state. And what is this about, this piece of land, this region, and these people, Michael? I mean, I would just like your take on what are we seeing here today happening down there?
Well, this is the key part of how, in fact, the concept of even an Israel nation or an Israel state came into being. What is this, and whose brainchild was it? Anyone who's done their homework studying the aftermath of the First and Second World Wars will know the feverish efforts of the British government, because when you're speaking about Israel or Zionism, what you're really speaking about, I mean, most of the masses of the world will not understand this because they've been ingesting, you know, the reports from the media, but anyone who's done any true historical research knows that when you're talking about international Zionism or the State of Israel, you're talking about British royalty, and you're talking about the Balfour Declaration of 1919, you're talking about the feverish division, artificial division of the land and the so-called nation-states that you have out there. Many of the borders are totally artificial. If you go back about 100 years and look at a map, you'll be surprised. If you look on a political map, you'll be surprised at how artificial the divisions that came later. In the aftermath of the First and Second World War, in that utter chaos and devastation and the evisceration of many of the countries over there, of course, of the combined power of the Allies, the British moved very, very quickly to re-establish countries, to put in their own potentates, and I mean even in Arab countries. This involves the Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Iran, making absolutely sure, as early as the 1800s, in fact, that nobody in those countries would be a significant threat to the real power.
Yeah.
They didn't mind if there was, secular conflicts. They didn't mind having a dialectic operating there. They didn't mind putting unlike people, ethnically and religiously, in close proximity to one another. This is by design, and people only have to study geographical political maps, you know, of the last couple of decades to realize this. The League of Nations is involved, which got created in 1919. Of course, you know, people may not be familiar with the term League of Nations, but they're certainly familiar with the United Nations. Well, the United Nations is the outgrowth of the League of Nations.
Yeah.
But long before that, Henrik, back in 1840, actually, one of the key figures that people need to, you know, do a Google search on, or go to the encyclopedias, go to online encyclopedias and look up, is a character by the name of Lord Palmerston.
Yeah.
Lord Palmerston. He is a central figure. So anyone who's thinking that Zionism is a creation, and the State of Israel and that particular conflict is a creation of the 20th century, is mistaken. Even up until the creation of the State of Israel, about 1940s, the Jews only actually took up about 11% of the population there. So they're a very, very small minority, and many of the rabbis around the world, when they first heard about this Zionist policy, which was scripted by the British government, were scratching their heads in disbelief. They couldn't believe that anything like this was going to happen.
Yeah.
So, but it goes back to 1840 with Lord Palmerston, and the reason is because Jews had been protected for many, many, many generations in the Middle East and in the Eastern Europe by the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
Okay, this is an empire, Turkish Ottoman Empire. But it was badly run, and in its latter days, it started to fade out, and it crumbled around about the early to the mid-1800s. The Ottoman Empire was pretty much gone. And this exposed Jews then who didn't have the protection of the Ottoman Empire. So the British government moved in, and there's a very important document called the Mandate for Palestine. Again, this was created. Lord Palmerston was urging in 1840 for that the Jews, what he called European Jews, should have their own homeland. Long before the 1900s, they were already doing this. But things really picked up in 1917 with the League of Nations, with the Versailles Peace Conference, which is jokingly, laughingly called a peace conference, because this Versailles Treaty is central to an understanding of modern history.
Yeah.
You can't understand the rise of Nazi Germany. You're not going to understand the rise of the Holocaust situation. You're not going to understand anything about world Jewry, the Soviets, or the modern situation politically that you see without an analysis of the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919.
Yeah.
And as I said, this was the document, and it was basically the brainchild of the British government, but their front men in this was Walter Rothschild, Herbert Samuel, and Chaim Weizmann. This was this artificial Zionism that had been merely a very fringe, sort of radical, vagrant concept within sort of extremist, you know, Judaic factions, and had never reached the table of any of the normal reformist Jews. It paid very little mind. It was a crackpot idea. But suddenly billions of dollars were put into it. The leading Zionists like Theodore Herzl and Chaim Weizmann and their coterie were given standing ovations. They were shipped to almost all the countries of the world to speak in the synagogues to try and beat into the minds of people, both Gentile and Jew alike, that this old edict, that there's some actual direct connection between modern Jews and the ancient cities of Jerusalem and the Holy Land. Of course, again, this is a preposterous nonsense, which ordinary assimilated Jews understood, that the 10 tribes of Israel had long assimilated into the Western lands and were key parts of the Western civilization. It had nothing to do with anything of the ancient world.
Yeah.
By the time that Lord Balfour, and by the way, Lord Balfour was the foreign secretary, but the man who really he was taking his orders from was Lloyd George. Okay, so Lloyd George is an extremely important prime minister, David Lloyd George. These are the people that need to, you know, and this Arthur Balfour had clandestine relationships with Jewish women, you know, in his own life. So he tended to favor the Jewish cause, and they drafted what was known as the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this is, though, and as I said, Lord Rothschild and the Rothschilds were deeply involved in this, and we could argue forever as to whether it was the Rothschilds and their power over the British royalty that moved things forward to the Balfour Declaration, or whether it was the British royals using the Rothschilds as front men towards the movement towards it. It's a, you know, it's like a juggling act. You can decide which for yourself.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about what's happening in the recent weeks is the understanding that on the very first paragraph of the Balfour Declaration, this is the declaration that got it, the ball rolling, and that got Britain deeply involved in the Middle East. Because did you know that it was the League of Nations edict, it was this mandate of Palestine and so on, that when the Ottoman Empire crashed, Britain, of all people, would be given the rights to administer what was happening in Palestine. Now, why, what on earth, you know, would that be? Why, when have you ever heard of one sovereign nation, right, discussing with another nation to give them property that doesn't belong to either?
Yeah, exactly.
The Jewish writer Arthur Koestler pointed this out. How can one nation go into a conference with another nation and promise them the land of a third nation? If this isn't bewildering, you know, it's on par with the Nuremberg laws, but it's even more obscene than that.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that in the first paragraph, and this is what we really need to understand, in the first paragraph of the Balfour Declaration, and I'll read it for you, it says, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Okay, that's that negotiation of giving foreign land to people without a land.
Yeah.
And we will use, and will use, their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in every in any other country.
Hmm.
So they say that you can have it, and the British government will work to make sure that you get it.
Yeah.
But we will not violate our friends over there, the Arabs, who've helped us in the war, who are extremely, you know, friendly with us, whose rights we are very much protecting. Well, of course they're protecting. As I told you, the countries that they were putting these potentates in was artificial. The Arab heads are British agents to this day.
Yeah.
So what we have to understand today is that the leaders of Zionism do not represent the Jews and are British agents. The Arab sheikhs and royal dynasties, laughingly called royal, of these Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq, are all also British agents. And that these extremist organizations of the Arabs, for instance this mythical Al-Qaeda, are also CIA, Mossad, Western creations.
Indeed.
But do you see, the important thing about the wording of this Balfour Declaration is it was very sweet. Of course, a lot of Jews would then be more likely to buy into this concept if they believed it was going to be a nice, egalitarian, politically just system. And the first paragraph is saying that you can have your homeland, but of course it's not going to violate anybody else who lives there. Well, then, if I was a Jewish person, I'd be thinking about it. I'd be thinking, okay, it sounds good, because Jews are mostly decent people.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And they're going to be thinking through the clever British wording that there's not going to be a drop of blood, there's not going to be any disputes, there's certainly not going to be the rise of any Mossad or any of the Israeli
secret service
terrorist organization.
Yeah.
Okay, they didn't expect to have these terrorist organizations that immediately formed very quickly afterwards. There's many of them.
Yeah.
And some of the Israeli prime ministers have been ex-members of these terrorist organizations. So how can terrorists now be suddenly promoted to president? I mean, even in America, you can't get that far. But in Israel, it's a normal.
That
you can be one day a mass murderer, officially a member of a terrorist organization in your own land, and the next minute you can be in the government over there.
Incredible.
How does this flow well with the Torah and with national justice and so on?
Yeah.
So when we are looking to the modern chaos and the rising of bloodshed and the slaughters that are going on, we must understand the British government, Lord Palmerston, Lord Balfour, David Lloyd George, and all of their henchmen ever since. Because once they had signed in the Balfour Declaration, then most of the governments in the future went along with it.
Yeah.
But you must also understand that when the Balfour Declaration was signed, major Jewish people, major Jewish politicians within the government of Lloyd George were completely against it.
Hmm.
Leading Jewish rabbis were against it, and many of the top Jewish politicians in the country were against it.
Hmm.
So that brings us to the old question of the nature of Lord Rothschild, and are these people really Jews, or are they just Zionists and royal henchmen posing as Jews in order to lead poor Jewish people into a deathly struggle?
Yeah.
You know, because I tell you, when I look at this, at any kind of conflict coming from the Middle East, I sympathize with both sides. I'm not into, you know, the he said, she said game of who's got more casualties and whose motives are right and wrong. No, I see both groups as absolutely caught in a credible game of chess run from the British London.
Yeah.
And then there's another important facet to this that people need to research. And we've got the information on this. And that is that I believe that one of the other major factors in the seizing of Britain wanting to get in there, when Britain had enormous problems of its own, why would it be interested in a sort of a nowhere place over there? Why would it start to covet and fund these radical Zionists who didn't even have an audience within their own religion or within their own ethnic groups?
Exactly.
They did it because in about the 1940s, 1930s, just after, within the few decades after the Bolsheviks had taken over in Soviet Russia, geologists were sent out, Henrik, to the Dead Sea Basin area. Actually, they were sent to all areas of the world to do geological research because the Soviets, being an empire of their own, basically, wanted to expand their territory and see what was going on.
Mm.
Especially in lands, and this is the interesting point, that had not been claimed, right, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Uh-huh.
It was very important for the Soviets to say, well, nobody's paying attention to a lot of these areas of land. There's little pockets of land here that the big Leviathan of Britain and America and these other our enemies are not looking at because they think they're, you know, a bunch of sheep herders. So geologists from Soviet Russia were sent out, and lo and behold, they discovered incredibly rich mineral deposits. I mean, vast, vast, vast amount in the Dead Sea. Everyone knows about the peculiarities geologically of the Dead Sea.
Yeah.
Well, what they probably don't know is the incredible caches there of magnesium and potassium and minerals that are needed in heavy industry. And their eyes were boggling out of their heads, and they sent the reports back to Moscow. But the trick is this, that, of course, anyone who's done 5 minutes of homework in the alternative history knows that the Soviet Union was an experiment funded itself from New York City and from London.
Yeah.
The entire communism, the Eastern Pact, the whole nine yards of it, was actually a concoction of secret enclaves within the Zionist movement of New York and America and in Britain. So therefore, this is proven now, because, of course, when those reports got to the Kremlin, how come they were not kept super secret? How come within 5 minutes America and Britain know about it? It's because those documents went back to the controllers of the Soviet experiment. And when the British government discovered that there was these mineral resources there, they knew they had to move in. But they couldn't move in overtly, because that would then spark incredible resistance from their Arab brothers at that time, because relations with the Arab states and with the British, as I said, was extremely, you know, benign.
Yeah, of course.
So the, they can't send in military factions to literally seize, and the days of the British Empire were gone. They weren't working like that anymore.
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons that I believe, from my research, there was a coveting and a grooming of these radical Zionists, because the greatest Zionists of the world, people like Theodor Herzl, on their deathbed recanted and said that they should never have been involved in such a thing. Because, as I said, they suddenly saw that it wasn't going to be nonviolent, and it wasn't going to be this beautiful socialist, utopian, you know, kibbutz-type paradise that the British have been promising the people of Israel. They were no better off. They were doing wonderful in the countries before they left. When they finally got to Israel, they were so meager. Things were so bad that most of the intellectual Jews there were wishing they had never left. And they said, we thought it was bad, you know, where we were. And we should never have bought into this. And, and Theodor Herzl himself said, yes, I wish I had not been a puppet of the British government. But they downplay that. You're not meant to hear that.
Amazing.
So the discovery of these mineral resources there is the reason why this conflict was created, because they said if they could create a faux Zionist movement that would come into conflict with the Arabs, all eyes would be on that conflict, and through the Zionist movement, we would lay claim then to the mineral resources there. And what we have to understand is this. The heavy mineral resources that are in the Dead Sea outweigh all of the earth put together.
Oh, really?
That's right. So it's like oil wells. It's like one guy saying, if I own this oil well, all your oil wells put together, of all your rivals anywhere in the world, it doesn't match it. So Lord Rothschild and the Warburgs, their eyes were bugging out of their heads, because these royal people want money. They need the resources of the earth, and they have, because they have other plans. And they knew that this is by all means important to get. So all of their previous arrangements, you see, with the Arabs, and to pacify them and to say, we're going to be on great working terms with you, we're going to be on excellent, you know, merchant terms with you. And we'll have great business relations with you. All of that went out the window. And the sabotagers and the subverters of a good world order, that probably would have been so much more better than what we have now in the aftermath of the war. Well, it would at least been more serving everyone. And serving, certainly saving the lives of many people in the Middle East, was subverted by the descendants of Lord Palmerston, by these pro-Zionist British factions. And this is where people need to look for these horrors today and understand that both groups are being duped.
That is incredibly important, I think, to highlight that fact, because it feels like a lot of people, they stop at Zionism and you know, see that as the ultimate conspiracy of basically everything. And of course, I mean, it isn't that the Zionist movement isn't working on on these things to, you know, claim the land and take over the region and all that, but that is extremely important to highlight that fact, I think, to, that it always goes deeper than the first level that we are, you know, allowed to see and research and get upset about, I guess. So,
you see, these factions of Zionists would never have been able to fund it or conceive it on their own had there not been the might of the British Empire behind it. You know, there are so many factions in this world within one religion. There are so many screwball notions and crackpots and fanatics, right, within every movement. But nobody's running around forming their own states.
No, exactly.
Nobody is arming troops and buying guns from America, you know, and a massive amount of weaponry. And, in fact, have never prevented an independent outsource either from the United Nations or from anywhere else, to invade their borders to actually come and examine what kind of weapons they really have. No, crackpot groups can barely do that. The Soviet experiment was funded by Britain and Russia, Britain and America. And the Zionist movement is a brainchild of some very elite personages involved with the British Empire, seeking to have empire under another name, seeking to create totally full conflicts. And of course, if one goes really deep into the theological side of it, one will understand the complete preposterousness of it. In fact, the Jews of the world are 80 to 90% Turco-Mongolic stock and European racially, and have no connection to any state of Israel, any Israeli Jerusalem of ancient times, except by religious conversion. What does this mean? It means that by their own definition, in their own history books, they talk about the assimilation of the 10 of the 12 ancient tribes of Israel. Because they say, theoretically, that they are related to these ancient tribes, and we have to look into that and say, okay, well, if that's the case, and then they say that in their own works, the 10 tribes of the house of Israel assimilated and were lost forever. They assimilated into the Western lands, married in with Western peoples, and are basically, you know, keeping their religion, but are assimilated racially. So then how can it be in 1948 that the Zionist movement, when they actually do, are given the land in the Middle East, in Palestine, name their state the State of Israel?
State of, exactly.
Why do they not name it the State of Judah, since only the two tribes, by their own definition of Judah, that's the tribes of Levi and Benjamin, are not assimilated? Actually, that's nonsense as well, but at least by their own statements they say that all the other 10 tribes are long gone and Israel is forgotten. Israel is the West. Israel is America. Israel is wherever the people of Israel assimilate and marry into.
Yeah.
So it was again a lie put before people. It was a lie put before the Jews who come to synagogue to misread and misinterpret ancient scripture.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. If these old historical anecdotes are not brought in front of the people, Henrik, then, of course, you have the rise of Jew baiters and Jew bashers and supremacists and extremists on the other side who are equally ignorant and who even, in fact, may be equally funded by hidden hands
exactly.
to rise up and create yet another dialectic blaming average, normal, assimilated Jews who don't know any of this, who are not condoning any kind of violence. And if they really had all the facts put in front of them, they'd be the first people to say, end it. Stop it. We can't be doing this under the name of our God.
Exactly.
So, again, just when you're about to answer the problem, in comes the other, and many on the Christian right are into this, who have got some very interesting pieces of the puzzle, but error. They have error in it because they are extremist. They believe themselves to be racially superior, and then they begin to, bash ordinary Jews who've got nothing to do with this. And, I myself will not be put into that category because I know my subject, and my sources come from Jewish sources, by the way, from Dr. Katzstein and from Arthur Koestler, and Benjamin Freeman, and many of the other writers who are Jewish, Max DeMont. You know, I don't take anything from other sources than from the original sources, from these doctrines and from these particular declarations that were signed.
Yeah.
People can go and read it and see for itself the cunningness of which the British Empire groomed these extremists.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I recently published here an article by Barry Chamish. I don't know if you've heard of him. Barry Chamish.
Chamish.
Yeah, Barry Chamish. And he have hinted, a few times now in his articles that about this issue that the Jews of the region and the Arabs of the region are being duped, to fight this war over each other. And he has also hinted, at that the deliberate destruction of Israel might be at hand, because if they have used this country as an instrument to gain, gain ground and do what they're supposed to do. He recently said, that he thinks of even a possible merger in this region, just to, basically he says, that there's no need for the State of Israel anymore and that it will be gone. I mean, what's your take on that?
That could happen, because remember, if conflict goes to the point where there is a lot of casualties, then people will, of course, react, and they'll say, look, we're meant to be living in an era of world peace and world order, and how come our people are being slaughtered again?
Yeah.
Then the United Nations, with impunity, can say, well, of course, what we need to do is create a buffer zone, and if you've watched the pro-Zionist evangelist news on this on America over here, you will see that they've already dropped that hint.
Mm.
And they will say that, yes, we have to have a buffer zone between Lebanon and Israel, we'll have to build more walls, we'll have to be, more careful.
Hmm.
And what might also happen is that just simply people stop going to Israel. They start backing out of all of this.
Yeah.
And I think that the numbers, I believe actually personally, that the numbers of immigration to Israel have actually been falling drastically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that, because remember, the only reason why people went there in the earlier part of the, or the middle part of this, of the 20th century, Henrik, was because they were being ousted from Soviet Russia. They couldn't stand the intolerable, situations in Russia, which were very harsh.
Yeah.
And also then, of course, we remember Germany, and where they were fleeing from Germany and from during the First and Second World War. But we're not in a war zone anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the need for people to be in this dust bowl out there,
so
it's funded by billions and billions of American dollars, they're thinking, no, wait a minute, we have our cousins and uncles and other relatives living very, very well in England and in America and Canada, and they're living it up. What are we doing out here in this dust bowl? So the novelty wears off, you see.
Yeah, exactly.
And I believe that the numbers have been steadily dropping, and this is why we have the Flight of Eagles, which is these are Christian organizations. You can get into the internet and look at Flight of Eagles, in which they're asking Gentile Christians to fund people, all Jews of the world. You can actually donate $700 and send Jewish families back to Israel. Now, they would not be doing any of this if there was a natural flow to Israel and if the Israeli government was saying, listen, hey, we've maxed out our quota here, we're full up.
Yeah, of course.
So there's suspicion that the Israeli experiment is about to fail. And, of course, then you heat that up, don't you, by having your other side, Hezbollah, funded by America, funded by CIA, funded by the British government, to start bombing and causing atrocities so that then there's a legitimate response to the Israel, you know, pro-Israel, especially from these rabid evangelists, because you do it by carrot and stick. The carrot is to drop the bombs to get sympathy, but then you have the whip crackers behind to goad you forward just in case you're lagging behind.
Yeah.
Which are these pro-Zionist Pat Robertsons, you see, and John Hagee's, and Parsley, Rob Parsley, and all of these people in the TBN network and the Christian movement over here, especially Van Imp. And all of these people are funded from the Dutch royal houses. They're all agents of the British Crown and also of the Vatican, by the way. What people think are the Protestant pastors here, the true Protestant pastors have been overthrown long ago. They've been compromised, especially in American soil, and they've been replaced by these ecumenical pastors who appear to be Protestant on the surface, but they're actually agents of the Jesuits.
Amazing.
Yeah, another secret history of America that has not been, well, has been told, but these authors are suppressed.
Yeah.
Like Bill Hughes and, Phelps, John Phelps. The whole secret of how the Jesuits have destroyed the true voice of the Protestant America and put their own pastors in there who will not speak against Vatican like it used to be done. Oh, yeah, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, if you went into a, you know, Protestant church, a great deal of the lectures, a great deal of the seminary and the discussion and the preaching there was also to educate you about the evils of the Vatican.
Yeah, exactly. To create
whether you like it or not, that was a mainstay of Protestant, you know, churches, is that they give leaflets out, they give you booklets, they referred you to sources, so that you, the Protestant masses, could educate yourselves to know that there was something vile going on in the world, which is why you're trying to break away and have your own religion.
Exactly.
Well, these pastors, I don't know if you know this, were actually removed. They were compromised either sexually or they were destroyed financially in an extremely important campaign that even President Lincoln knew about. He endorsed that this was going on. He admitted. And he said, yes, this kind of thing is going on. And whistleblowing from within the Catholic Church. It was Jesuit people who left the order because this was happening, and who whistleblew, that explained that this was in fact happening. So this was to get rid of American Protestantism, which would be very, very anti-Zionist and very anti-Catholic and anti-Vatican, and that had to go because you wouldn't be able to do the things that you were doing in the Middle East. You wouldn't be able to sanction Zionism if you had a strong coterie of educated clergymen, you see, pastors over in this country, in America, who were telling it as it is. Because America is an extremely prestigious country, and all of the world would have looked to America as being a neutral and objective and involved and highly knowledgeable country when these kinds of cataclysms were taking place in other countries. People, intellectual class, would have said, well, what do the Americans think? What's coming out of America? So the powers that be had to make sure that they had a fifth column working to destroy the true nexus of what we're calling Protestantism on paper here, so that never could be an opposition to their machinations. So this is why we have a void. We have a big void when it comes to knowledge about these conflicts that are taking place, even the ones in Israel, certainly the ones in Northern Ireland, a lot of other conflicts that have taken place in the world.
Yeah, and I guess that the religious climate almost is such in certain areas, I guess, that you know, they're almost like they're waiting for the return of Christ, and in order for that to happen, we get to have this, you know, turbulent period, basically World War III, before this can happen. And I guess we have a climate now where people, you know, anticipate this and kind of, you know, almost wish for the violence to begin to start. So, I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, well, what you said is absolutely key. This is one of the key components. I'm glad we actually got to this. Because what we were talking about before, which may have been some crackpot type of, skewed religious understanding or an interpretation of a few Bible chapters, not always interests only a few people.
Yeah.
That is, especially even, I mean, even to this day, I'll tell you, that in Israel, people must not assume that all the Arabs and all the Jews are totally in favor of what's going on.
Of course not.
They have their own political parties with the extremists on one side and the moderates on the other. Not everyone is wanting this to happen. But if you watch the television or listen to the media, they make you think it's all Israel.
Hmm.
Or it's all, you know, the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Or all the Lebanese. Absolute nonsense. And the same thing applies with this theological point that you're talking about. Without the funding of these pro-Zionist evangelists and the bankers and the big money houses here and the secret society enclaves and also the British royals, absolutely no one would be taking this spurious Christian nonsense about the return of Jesus and then the state of Israel will be reformed.
Yeah.
But if you pump a lot of money into something, then it sounds wonderful. They've already doctored the Bible and they've changed so many verses. Man, you could do a 5-hour talk on the way that the Bible now looks.
Yeah.
As compared to what it even did 10 or 15 years ago. It's
yeah.
so skewed. It's been so changed in even its wording. But anyway, that's exactly right. They are now giving theological basis because people are pretty jaded with the political situation and don't understand what the rivalry is all about. But what they do fall back on is this instinctual programming, which has been going on for a lot longer, based on theology.
Yeah.
They don't understand that both the Torah and the Bible are saying, thou shalt not kill. They're not noticing that the Balfour Declaration says, we will not violate the sovereignty of the people that are already living there.
Exactly.
You'll all work together. You'll all love one another. Because that's what it says in the Quran, and that's what it says in the Torah.
Yeah.
They didn't say we're going to fund terrorist organizations. But you must, just George Bush's entire presidency has been based on a theological coding of absolute neocon, neoconservative, utterly preposterous, extremist nonsense that if it was presented in front of the people normally, they'd laugh him out of court. They'd have the guy's ass impeached long ago. He never would have gotten anywhere near the White House. Even his own father is more moderate than he was, for God's sake. His father refused to take sides and to, you know, cause conflict of this dimension anywhere, especially to involve itself in Iraq and Iran. He wouldn't really do it. In fact, you remember during the hostage crisis, it was Saddam Hussein who let the CIA agents in backdoor so that they could spy on Iran during the hostage crisis of the 1980s.
Hmm.
All those hostages that Reagan got freed, remember?
Was this in the Munich thing that happened during the Olympics? Is it that we're talking about?
The hostage. There was many hostages taken in the Reagan era, 1980, by Iran. The Iran hostage crisis.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I see.
Well, it was Saddam Hussein who allowed CIA operatives, because they were all best friends at that time, in to use the back door in order to surveil what was taking place in Iran, and that's the reason why the hostages were released, is because of the CIA operations in northern Iran, spying and finding out what was going on, courtesy of Saddam Hussein, whose entire culture was friendly with America and Britain.
Yeah.
The doctors and all of the expert, all of the professionals in Iraq have been educated in the West.
Exactly.
Money had come from the West.
Yeah.
You see? So one minute these people, it's just like the old Bosnia crisis we were talking about on a previous interview with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, one minute these people are allies and friends, and the next minute they're the worst enemies on the world.
Yeah, it switches so fast. Whenever it's convenient, so.
Now, two things that also involve the Middle East. They're now claiming that Iran is a rising threat. Five years ago, you never even heard that.
Yeah.
2 years ago, you never even heard that. 1 year ago, you never even heard that.
Mm.
Now they're telling you that Iran is a big threat.
Yeah.
Could that be simultaneous? Just in case they are a little nervous and they are building up their armaments, well, could there not be a legitimate reason for that? That since America has all of its bases surrounding those lands, like Iran, because now Afghanistan and Turkmenistan, you see, and all of the Kurdistan are all under American domination, would you not, as a country, be incredibly, sort of afraid and on the panic button if military American bases
of
a Christian, again, a dissimilar ethnic, dissimilar religious bases are surrounding you like a bunch of hyenas?
Yeah.
What happens if the situation was reversed?
Exactly.
Wouldn't America? My God, America's been trigger happy just with a little Cuba off of its shores.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just turn the situation around, and you'll see probably where it ends up. And of course, not that too long ago, they had an election or alleged election in Iran, and they. You know, got in a new president in Iran, and of course the first thing I can recall he was doing, He was just, going out, doing these kinds of press releases where he said that Israel need to be wiped off the map. I mean, that draws attention to the country and to all of Iran. So that's not pretty smart, I guess.
Remember, I was saying that these leaders of the Arabic countries are all agents of the British government.
Yeah.
And the secret societies. That's what they are. They're agent provocateurs.
Yeah.
They do exactly the bidding. When the red phone rings, then these creatures, who are all educated, by the way, in Eton and Oxford and Cambridge, people can check into that. Their ambassadors are also all educated in the West. And that doesn't just mean I went to England and got an education. No, it means I went to England and bought into the system. I am there courtesy of the British government, who are educating me on how world politics works, global geopolitics works. The other thing I was going to say is that now you have all of these maniac extremists running around in Iraq, butchering, slaughtering, executing, slitting people's throats, killing American troops and even their own people, right?
Yeah.
Those people were always extremists. Those fanatics that are now fighting the American troops and causing so much problem, of course that's by design, but these particular groups that are exist within Iran have been existing in Iran for hundreds of years. They are not a symptom of Saddam Hussein's reign. They were the reason for his reign.
Exactly.
Saddam Hussein had to keep these people in check. So when people are claiming he did this and he did that and he was very punitive and he was the only one who learned, because he lived there, he knew these people and he knew how fanatical they were, and his evil empire that has been put before us for the last 10 to 15 years happened to be the evil empire that kept an even worse evil at bay.
Yeah, at first, of course, yeah.
Right, because these Shiites and these other maniacs, these interpreters of the Quran, these true jihadists, if they exist, I'm saying that, I'm not even completely sure that's true, but of course we know that every nation has its extremists. I come from Ireland, I know that they exist.
Exactly.
I also know they're funded from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that Saddam Hussein kept these people so they wouldn't squeak, so they wouldn't be murdering each other on the name of some stupid book, some lines in a book.
Yeah.
So the thing is this, that now that they've removed Saddam Hussein, these people are going mad, and nobody in the West knows how to deal with it.
Interesting.
There you
point.
Go. So yeah. there's designer chaos. Now, do you think that the geopoliticians in the Brookings Institute and RAND Corporation and the Council of Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs and who had experts, million-dollar experts, million-dollar think tanks on the Iraqi crisis and the Iraq and Iran didn't know that? That if you take Saddam Hussein out, this is going to happen?
Of course they did. Order out of chaos, of course.
That's right. Order out of chaos. Same thing you have in this Al-Qaeda myth. There is no Al-Qaeda. There never has been an Al-Qaeda. The closest thing to Al-Qaeda was American neocon-funded Islamic extremists operating in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets.
Exactly.
Period. And if you want to go and read the 35 or 300, or go on Amazon, there's thousands of books on the Taliban and on the crisis written by the greatest Western scholars, right?
Yeah.
On the period of the Afghani war against the Soviets and the American intervention. And so you will see from all of those books, or you can just take my word for it, that the closest possible thing to an Al-Qaeda that ever existed was funded openly, on paper, by the American and British government, Islamic extremists who were petitioned to be released from the world's jails, in which many other countries like Egypt had already put them in jail. Mm. They were compelled to be released. They grouped themselves, they rendezvoused in Afghanistan to help fight the Soviets.
Yeah.
When the Soviet army was leaving, the top generals, including the president of Soviet Union, said that now you've got rid of us, America, but I warn you that you have a greater problem on your hands because of all the people that you've been using to fight against us.
Yeah.
Now that we move out, you're going to have a major problem on your hands with these Arab extremists, these Islamic extremists coming out of Pakistan and funded from extremist groups in India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
What do we have now? Exactly that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the creation of Al-Qaeda is a CIA and Mossad creation.
So how far do you think this time that they will go? I mean, we have, as we quoted here on an earlier program we did together, about the Albert Pike and his letter to Giuseppe Mazzini about the Third World War and about that this potentially lies in the plans of these secret societies and that it will begin, as he states, in between a clash between political Zionism, the State of Israel, and the Islamic Arabic world. I mean, is this it, do you think?
It might be. Theologically, it has a lot of currency, the whole idea of the Crusades. And we mustn't forget the lineage of George Bush going all the way back to the First Crusade. the dynasties that were involved in leading the First Crusade, these bloodthirsty dynasties, by the way, are directly linked to the present administration by blood.
Hmm.
There are also major dynastic rivalries that can bring the New World Order situation into place, or at least precipitate it. Obviously, we know that the royal dynasties, any of the power establishment, the brotherhoods of the world, always, they're very vulnerable. So they like to hide themselves behind the camouflage of all of these secular disputes. We always know that down through history, there's always the creation of a nemesis, so that people are able to purge their murderous inner feelings.
Yeah.
You may not go and murder yourself, but then you hire a president to send professional murderers to do your dirty work.
Yeah.
A lot of this has also psychological currency, where people can feel good about, we tend to feel better about what we've got when we see other people who have not.
Exactly, yeah, I understand.
And the same thing works theologically. And we have to understand one thing, and that the masses of the world are not only mostly ignorant, but they're also deeply violent and criminal. People left to their natural instincts are incredibly barbarous. Look at just the nature of what's being done to nature and what's been done to animals.
Mm.
So, if we get used to it, we don't quite see it. So one of the ways to do it is to have incredible conflicts in the world, ritualistically created conflicts, dialectically created conflicts. This is put into the hands of the Freemasons who understand all of this.
Yeah.
You get these people to orchestrate these massive, utterly atrocious forms of violence so that everybody's little, what might be called soft violence, is a little bit more invisible.
Hmm.
See, a person like me observes the what we call the soft violence everywhere.
Yeah.
Even if it's hidden behind a smile or some domestic, claptrap of a relationship or a business or in your job.
Yeah.
And the constant undercutting of your friends and the backstabbing and gossiping. See, I understand violence quite differently than most people.
Yeah.
I see it everywhere. I see it every time somebody sits down to a steak dinner. They're endorsing the rape and mutilation and slaughter of millions upon millions of animals.
Oh,
they sit there and smile.
I agree totally.
So the culture of violence is widespread. It just so happens that in this culture, in this mountain heap of, shivering violence that is in the world,
yeah,
the Bushes and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds and the Blairs and the Adolf Hitlers, you see, and the Mussolinis and all of these kinds of people and the Pol Potts, they are just the people at the top.
Yeah.
It's like the reverse of cream. Cream floats to the surface. Well, in politics, the rubbish floats to the surface. The worst kind of, evil ends up on the top.
The scum rises to the surface,
right.
Yes.
Because when you have no conscience, it's easy to win the game.
Yeah.
Right? When you disobey the rules of a game, then it's easy to win.
Yeah.
And this is what has happened in our culture. So, and then the kind of thinking that you're talking about, that Giuseppe Mazzini and Pike are talking about, is the kind of thinking of that kind of parasitical, vampiristic kind of individual.
Yeah.
In order for their own stench not to seem so bad, for their own inner psychosis and sadism to not be literally pathologically destructive,
yeah,
to themselves and to their friends, what they do is they want to create a culture of mayhem and total violence, because this they, yeah, know makes their own, it's like anyone, wanting to, it's like maggots will be expected on a corpse. Rats will be expected in a sewer. So these individuals don't feel good, Henrik, in a climate of peace and love and Christian charity and all these kinds of things.
I see. And people like you and many others, of course, have been, warning about this, about the climate that is ongoing and all of the conspiracy to create these kinds of problems. But, I mean, is this the time now, finally, then, for even the average Joe, to be worried that this will actually come to their door also? Because, I mean, we up here in the West have been relatively, guarded from war, real war in a long time. But, I mean, do you think that it could spread now?
Yes, and it already has. I mean, the ultimate war, I keep saying in my work, which is very different than most of the other writers on alternative history and most of the other conspiracy teachers, I never leave consciousness at the door. So I believe that the great war that's been taking place has been a war of on consciousness. And I believe that it's been mostly psychic in nature, even though it takes other, physical, secular, political, social permutations. It is mostly an assault on consciousness. So we're in a difficulty because there's been so much tranquilization of people, there's been so much dumbing down of individuals,
yeah,
that even though the wolf is very much at the door in a political sense, most people are wanting it. And I'll tell you why. It's because the war has been on consciousness and on the sovereignty of the psyche, most people in their ego life are extremely fragile and insecure and fearful. It is indeed a war on terror. They're actually telling you that. But terror is a psychological term. It is indeed an ordo out of chaos situation. But chaos is of thinking before it is of society. In fact, you'll see very little chaos socially.
Yeah.
Chaos is in the thinking, Henrik, not in the streets. Even in Ireland. Okay, so a couple of people threw a few bottles in the street now and again, but I would never describe it as chaos. No. The chaos is in the thinking. So we have to realize that this is a thing of consciousness. Now, the problem is that because the war has been in consciousness, because people have ingested so many falsities and lies, the ego of man, his inner psychic sovereignty, is extremely weak. It's like a wall, it's like a castle that's been besieged for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Practically nothing left. So then doesn't that make the average Joe, as you say, very susceptible to saying, well, okay, George, okay, Margaret Thatcher, okay, Blair, you know, I have no inner security whatsoever. I'm a complete and utter wreck.
Yeah.
Sociologically, psychologically, you know, spiritually. I'm raped from my inner, I believe, a bunch of theological nonsense that's been put before me by my priest. I believe a bunch of political nonsense has been put before me by the destroyers of the world.
Yeah.
And I have no brain. I don't think for myself and never have. But you seem to do the thinking for me. And since you're already my master and could easily destroy me, I better identify with you and identify with your power. Well, tell you what. I'll vote for you, and you just tell me as it is. Do you want me to put my arm out and so you can stamp me with a number? Do you want to put my, you know, forehead out so you can put the barcode on me?
Yeah.
Do you want me to have four or five types of identification when I rent a video downtown or buy an ice cream or a pizza?
Oh.
Okay, I'm for it.
My God.
Because I'm deeply threatened by my neighbor. I'm deeply threatened by the guy down the street. You know, I do believe that our borders are wide open. I'm in a state of complete pathological paranoia. Actually, I should be on a psychiatrist bench, but then, you know, so would everybody that I go to school with and so would everybody I work with. We're all in the same consensus trap.
Yeah.
So the only stability that I therefore have, the only railing that I can hold on to is the railing that I have a steady job, I get into my car at 6 a.m. in the morning, I drive with everybody else to work like a robot, I sit behind that table, I don't do any thinking, I have my little American flag on my car and support the troops on my bumper sticker, and then I drive home and I sit in front of the TV and they're going to tell me what's going to go happening, and George is going to tell me, Big Daddy is going to assure me everything's under control.
Yeah, it's a trauma, it's a state of trauma almost.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. Ah. And this traumata is what I have been. So you're right in a way. People like myself have been warning people, or shall we say, you know, Cassandras, telling people what's going on. But I would be more specific. I would say that it is to this psychological warfare that people like myself have been addressing.
Mm.
And you can actually rate the people in the alternative history movement and the conspiracy movement. Excuse me if I say this myself, but you can rank them by how much emphasis they put on the psychological warfare against consciousness, or whether they're merely describers as it appears, sort of like journalists with a notebook, as it appears in the external world. I think both are good, but the former is even better. The former teacher is the one who's aware of its subtle effects and is not just a reporter when it finally hits the streets and they know what's going on.
You can rank.
There's a rank of superiority within the people who work in this field to know how the war is actually conducted, as opposed to be somebody who just goes out there and reports on it second, third hand once it's now become, you know, sort of public domain, so to speak.
Yeah, of course. So is there anything you'd like to, you know, to finish off this topic here? Is there anything more you'd like to add here?
Yeah, well, the last thing is that really that, see, we are in an age in which the true opposition against these establishment brotherhood-type people has begun. I've said this many times, and I emphasize people to be optimistic, because it's not like our forefathers of old who didn't have access and didn't even suspect what was going on. They didn't have schools, they didn't have newspapers, and therefore their only job, you see, was to work for the feudal lord and make sure he didn't kill you. That was it. That was the extent of our forefathers' sort of rights, is obey the feudal lord and put up with his abuses and just make sure that you didn't get strung up from a tree. Okay, that was the sole concern of almost all the population of the earth.
Yeah.
And wait till the Lord decides he's going to have a battle, and then he sends you and your sons and brothers out to be slaughtered.
Yeah.
That's basically what we've had up until very recent times. So we are now in a moment in the late 20th century and in the 21st century, which is the first few decades we have to even suspect, let alone find out, and let alone broadcast or teach to other people in the world what is going on. So I am not in a state of pessimism at all. I am surprised that we've even got this far. Yes, people are dumbed down. Yes, they're in a terribly jaded, tranquilized state. But that's to be expected when you have a culture of lies. I don't find it abnormal.
No, of course not.
I find it as a perfectly natural reaction to an unnatural, abnormal situation.
Yeah.
And the final point is that what we need to understand, if we're ever going, now that we know that a lot of people are waking up to find out that there is some kind of conspiracy against the consciousness and against mankind, Now that we know that, where do we go forward? We go forward by understanding one thing, that it is primarily a war against consciousness, and that's where your focus needs to be. It does not need to be on some sort of political or social action. It needs to be on psychological, spiritual, inner action. Other than that, you need to know that all of these little coteries and little lieutenants running around screaming and bombing and killing and murdering, that is just the carnival. That's just the theater production. That is just the carnival of horrors made for TV so that you think, oh my goodness, the world is so threatening, I cannot believe, I'm so destabilized, I can't imagine this kind of death, what these people are going through. Mm. And what this is doing is, again, chiseling away at a man and a woman's sovereignty, their feeling of psychic stability. If you buy into that, it is horrific. It's made to be horrific. It's a movie courtesy of the Queen of England and her bosses, the Rothschild dynasty, see, the Rockefellers and everybody else who's involved in this. And it's courtesy of the Pope, by the way. These horror shows are wonderful theater productions for them, except they happen to be in real time.
Yeah.
But their job is to come into your household to destabilize your spiritual power, to make you fear for your kids, to make you fear for your religion, to make you fear for your nation, to make you fearful, so that slowly, they're able to have you step over the boundary and say, please, Lucifer, come and save us.
Oh, my God. It's an incredible manipulation going on, and I think it's perfect to end on, in that sense, a positive high note, that it is up to us, and it is, you know, up to us to regain our, you know, our consciousness and our our positive thinking, and you know, start having this positive outlook on life, no matter what the movie is, what the game plan is.
That's right. Now, you cannot blame these people for doing what they're doing. If they are Freemasons or members of brotherhoods or connected to royal families and dynasties, they have taken oaths of allegiance. And I would not expect these people to break their oaths of allegiance. If I was a member of the brotherhood, I would also accept death if I, you know, turned coat. So that's not my problem.
Yeah.
My message is to the people, the humanity of the world, saying you also have an oath to truth, an oath to justice, and an oath to one another. These are your enemies. They understand you as an enemy, and they give you the free right to occupy the white square if you choose to occupy the white square. If you don't occupy it, then, of course, it goes to them by default. But the people who are good and the people who are sane also have an allegiance to truth, to humanity, and to justice. And that is what you stand on when you oppose these kinds of people. There's no reason to be pessimistic. This is the beginning of the full battle of the forces of true light and darkness to once and for all rid the world and rid humanity of this virus, these pestilence and these vultures that exist in the world.
That's amazing. Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay.
Thank you for your time and for your, you know, your great perspective on things.
Thank you, Henrik. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Absolutely. We'll talk again, Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye. Very soon.